The American dream has become a nightmare. Signs of the time are on cardboard, on corners in town.
It is Thursday, February 12th, 2015. Thanks for listening to RBN, whose website is republicbroadcasting.org. This is the National Intel Report. This is Deanna Spingola, and I am subbing for John Stattmiller, who tore a muscle in his back moving furniture there at the office yesterday. He had every intention of conducting his own show today, but is barely able to sit down. During the program, if you have questions or comments, please email me at comment@spingola.com. Join others in my chat room at spingola.chatango.com. John called me at about 2:30 and invited me to do the program, and I'm honored to have the opportunity. I do not feel comfortable promoting my work, but given that this is kind of impromptu, I'm going to talk about some of my own research in conjunction with the 70th anniversary of the bombing of Dresden. So with that, I invite you to visit my website at spingola.com. And at the top of the page, you will see my three books. It's a trilogy. The first one really starts prior to the so-called Civil War. And the first one talks about World War One. And the third one talks about World War II. They're pretty lengthy books. I get a little carried away, and I do like to tell all the details, give all the background, give all the information. And in fact, the third book, which is called The Ruling Elite, Death, Destruction, and Domination, is a book that is, well, it is 794 pages long. But it's the kind of book that you can read each chapter, by itself. You can read the whole thing from beginning to end, or you can pick and choose whichever way you'd prefer to read a book. But anyway, I thought that I would talk about this, because as I mentioned, it is the 70th anniversary of the Allied bombing of Dresden. Now, I really like timelines, and so I've created a timeline of book 2 and 3 of the trilogy. And with a timeline, it's kind of like having a map where you're not going to venture out on a trip without knowing exactly where you're going. You want to have everything connected so that you can take the best route. So I think that a timeline is very, very effective in setting out a particular, well, you can see what happened in any given year. And in some years, there were so many things that happened that you kind of think, my gosh, this was all planned, wasn't it? And of course, that is the way that things work out. And the timeline starts, well, way back in 1762. And so, all of these things that I've listed on the timeline, I think are essential to understand what is going on now. And I've always said that history is prologue. In other words, if you want to know what is going on now and why it is happening, you need to understand and acknowledge or know about what has happened in the past. And I've talked a lot about false flag events. And false flag events usually are national events. They involve a national agenda. And of course, warfare is always a national event. People kind of ask me, what is a woman doing talking about warfare? And I have no idea why I talk so much about war, other than the fact that it is absolutely appalling that millions and millions of people have perished through warfare. Okay, we're going to a quick break. We will be back in 3 minutes. righty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and as I mentioned before, I am subbing for John Stattmiller, and I appreciate the opportunity. And I'm going to just give you a few chapter titles in my book 3, and it does cover the things that happened prior to the war. In fact, it talks about the genesis of factory farming and the Havara Agreement and Birobidzhan, all kinds of things. And I cover a lot of a lot about Hitler and the rebirth of Germany, which is the first section in the book. And I talk about the Worldwide Masonic Brotherhood, the official history of Adolf Hitler as presented by the Allies. And in conjunction with that, let me just mention a new company that I just became aware of called ABE Books. And I was able to, in fact, I traded with them some very nice books, one of which is called The Real Hitler by V.S. Harrell. Another one is entitled Positive Christianity in the Third Reich by Fabry Sisius, which was printed originally in 1937. And then Christian Principles of National Socialism by Jacob End. And Was Adolf Hitler a Bible Christian? Again by V.S. Harrell. And that is Abe Books, and their website is abebooks.com, abebooks.com. Alrighty, I was talking about the timeline. I was also mentioning the some of the titles in my book, or some of the chapter titles in my book. And then we get into the war, talk about Ukraine. And in writing this book, honestly, I shed a lot of tears. Now, I know that the people who listen to my program are probably not surprised that I would shed a few tears over writing about the deaths of millions of people and the scoundrels behind all this warfare. And it certainly was not Adolf Hitler. He did everything possible that he could to prevent a war, to avoid a war. And it was Churchill and Roosevelt, and the United States actually started building bombs, getting ready for this bombing as early as 1936. And I give all of that information, all of the things that happened before that. I talk about the creation of Poland. I talk about a lot of things, about the Polish and their sorties into German territory. I talk about the Gliwice incident, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. All the things kind of led up to the war. And the war is quite awful. One of the chapters in my book is Warfare by Firestorm. So I'm going to share that with you. And as I mentioned, if you'd like to email me during the program with questions or comments, comment@spingola.com. And of course, please feel free to join the other chatters in the chat room, which is spingola.chatingo.com. Now, their author, I mispronounce a lot of names, Friedrich writes, and I quote, "The firestorm is apotheosis of fire raising. Until September 1944, it could not be deliberately produced. It could only be triggered when human destructive rage coupled perfectly with natural phenomena." Unquote. Britain and France declared war on Germany on September 3rd, 1939. On that day, Britain bombed German warships in several harbors, killing 8 Kriegsmarine men at Wilhelmshaven, the war's first casualties. Germany's first bombing strikes against the British did not occur until October 16th and 17th. So it was quite some time, 6 weeks, before Germany responded. As winter began, bombing ceased while both sides engaged in a propaganda war, dropping leaflets on the populations below. Now, it was actually Germany who did a lot of the dropping of leaflets, but their leaflets were somewhat different. In fact, they dropped leaflets in Warsaw, warning the civilians about their intentions so that the civilians would have an opportunity to make preparation, because it was the Polish leaders who resisted any kind of negotiations, any kind of peace talks at all. And so Germany did not feel that it was fair that the civilian population would have to suffer because of the behavior and the decisions that the leaders were making. Now, the RAF and Imperial Chemical Industries developed the flame jet bombs in 1936. And after successfully testing them, ordered 4.5 million of them in October. By the time war erupted, they had 5 million in stock. So you see, they were planning this war very early on. All they had to do was provoke Germany by doing anything possible in the 3 years. And that is exactly what they do. They made deals with the Polish leaders, and of course the Americans collaborated with the Germans, or with the British. And the British and the United States had been kind of cronies, collaborating since 1897, when they made a deal that when either of them engaged in any kind of warfare, that they would both benefit from the booty. So from 1897 forward, they were pals in arms. And of course, this applied to World War I and World War II. So by the time that war erupted, they had 5 million of these bombs, these flame jet bombs in stock. They manufactured them with magnesium thermite, which produced a terrific weapon for a horrific fire war. By 1944, instead of dropping single bombs, Britain would figure out a way to cluster them together in such a way that when they hit their target, they instantaneously burst apart to generate a firestorm. These bombs devoured Darmstadt, Heilbronn, Forzheim, and Würzburg. The bomb's flammable contents included gasoline, rubber, synthetic resins, oil, liquid asphalt, gels, metal soaps, acid, and phosphorus. And it was most deadly power next to nuclear weapons. After the Altmark incident on February 16, 1940, the Luftwaffe initiated a strike against the British Navy Yard at Scapa Flow on March 16, leading to the first British civilian death. That's quite a ways into the war. The war, of course, began on September 1, 1939. The British then attacked the German air base at Hornum, hitting a hospital, but there were no casualties. The Germans retaliated with a naval raid. On May 10th, Germany invaded Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg, planning to push through the Ardennes into France, intending to strike quickly and effectively in the hopes of ending the war. An attack that started the Battle of France. Germany began bombing several cities in France on the evening of May 9th, 10th, killing at least 40 civilians by May 11th. On May 12th, the British began their initial attacks on transport targets in the German industrial Ruhr Valley, including Cologne. the British targeted troop columns and bridges and limited bombing raids of roads and railroads west of the River Rhine. The first British bombs fell on Mönchengladbach on the evening of May 11th and 12th, allegedly while Bomber Command was trying to hit roads and railroads near the Dutch-German border. Okay, we will be back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and as I mentioned, I am subbing for John Stadtmiller. And John called me maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I wasn't home. He left a message, and he said, I just stayed up the entire night and watched The Greatest Story Never Told. And this, of course, was produced, directed, written by the wonderful, the great Dennis Wise, who I just have so much appreciation for. And John said it was the most provocative movie that he had ever watched, that he could not stop watching it, that literally he'd stayed up all night. And so if you have not had the opportunity to watch that movie, that video, it's 6 hours, but you won't be able to stop watching it. Just as John couldn't. He just, it just holds your attention and you learn things that you never, ever were taught in school, or certainly not by Hollywood. It is a fabulous, fabulous production, and thanks to Dennis Wise for producing that wonderful, wonderful video. Again, it is entitled Greatest Story Never Told. Alrighty, back to Germany, and of course we are remembering Dresden. The Allies bombed Dresden between February 13th through the 15th, 1945. It is the 70th anniversary tomorrow, and through the weekend. So the Germans threatened to bomb Rotterdam in order to persuade the Dutch to surrender. The Germans issued a second ultimatum, which failed. They always gave plenty of warning, always said, you know, please, let's negotiate, let's stop this. But the British and the Americans were certainly compelling the war, forcing the war. So therefore, on May 14th, officials ordered the Luftwaffe to bomb Rotterdam to force the capitulation of the besieged city. When Winston Churchill became prime minister, and this occurred on May 10th, 1940, and it's very interesting that Churchill and Roosevelt worked in the same capacity. They both worked in World War I in the same capacity, and then years later they would work again. Well, Winston Churchill was a prime minister and Roosevelt was a president, so they were old buddies, old cronies at waging warfare, and it was also against Germany, of course, in World War I. So we often think, or we're often told, well, World War II happened because of Hitler. Okay, well, was Hitler around during World War I? No, not at all. But Britain and America were after Germany in World War I also, and provoked a war, used false flags to do that also. Alrighty, so Churchill immediately used nefarious night raids against German cities, farms, and villages. Now, this is called total war. It used to be back before, well, actually before the so-called Civil War in America, that military people opposing nations would fight each other on a specific battlefield. They would line up on opposite sides and they would fight each other. It was just the military men that were involved. It was never civilians. Civilians were always off limits until the Civil War. So anyway, the British immediately targeted the citizens of Germany on their farms, in their villages, because the British could not penetrate German airspace during the day, especially from the North Sea. Wherever the British pilots saw a light, they would drop a bomb. Hitler did not respond to this bombing for 3 months because he thought that they would soon stop this brutal bombing. On September 4th, Hitler stated that the British viewed this as weakness on the part of the Germans. Germany then began sending planes and bombs to Britain at an increasing rate night after night. He said, and I quote, "We will put these nighttime pirates out of business. God help us." In the first British air raid on Cologne, named Operation Millennium, on May 30th through the 31st, 1942, the Allies used 1,000 airplanes with 1,455 tons of bombs, mostly incendiaries that generated over 2,500 fires. In addition to that assault, they bombed the city in at least 262 separate air raids. Okay, I think we're going to a break. Okay, we are. We'll be back in 3 minutes.
They came and took it all away.
Deanna, and I am subbing for John Stattmiller, and I appreciate the opportunity to do so. And I'm talking about some of the things that are in my book, my third book, which one may find information about at spingola.com. It's called The Ruling Elite, Death, Destruction, and Domination, the cover of which was created by David Deese, and it came out last year. So anyway, it's as I mentioned before, it's almost 800 pages, and it's mostly text. So it is a long read, but it has a lot of I think valuable information in it that will really educate people as to what happened several years before the war and several years after the war. I was talking about Operation Millennium, which occurred May 30th through the 31st in 1942. And these were bombs that were created as early as 1936 by the Americans and by the British because, well, they were planning on this war. And of course, we know, as I indicated in the book, the actual war against Germany started with before World War I, there was a 30-year relief from war, wherein they just simply got ready for continued war after Churchill and Roosevelt came into power. And they always had a vendetta against Germany, always, that went back, quite a ways, which I will talk about some of the details of that. The death rate from the incendiaries that they used in Cologne, which was called Operation Millennium, was considerably lower than expected, fewer than 500 people the majority of them civilians. These air raids, however, left at least 45,000 people homeless. They bombed Frankfurt into a mass of rubble. They firebombed the port city of Hamburg with a population of 1,150,000. Thousands of civilians were roasted alive in temperatures of 1,000 degrees. Germany was formerly the most highly industrialized nation in Europe. And they did not suffer during the Depression as much as the people in the United States. Because of the decisions, because of the leadership of Adolf Hitler, he put at least 6 million people back to work without benefit of credit, of bank credit, without benefit of having any gold. And certainly if Germany could do that without the bankers, then every other country in Europe would follow suit. So there were several reasons why the war was instituted, why the British and the Americans went after Germany. America and Britain referred to their attacks on Hamburg as Operation Gomorrah. And this occurred July 24th through August 3rd, 1943. Churchill and Air Chief Marshal Arthur Harris, who's a despicable scoundrel, devised the strategy using coordinated strikes with the RAF and the U.S. Army Air Force. They dropped almost 8,000 tons of regular and incendiary bombs. On the night of July 27th, 1943, the fires created a huge fiery current with air temperatures of 1,800 degrees and 155 mile per hour winds that burned everything in its path. Cars, asphalt pavement, trees, everything fueled the fire, including people. This firestorm incinerated 50,000 people. More conservative sources report only 40,000. Either way, it was genocide. Later, in his honor, the RAF erected a bronze statue of Harris at St. Clement Danes Church in London. I hope he's roasting in hell. I really do. In 1940, the British had invented a 30-pound incendiary bomb and then produced 3 million of them by 1944. You know, this isn't warfare. This is genocide. Plain and simple, this is genocide. Unnecessary genocide of civilians. Then they looked unsuccessfully for a city that had not been bombed to test them on and had to settle for Brunswick, which had less damage than most. On the evening of April 22nd, 1944, the RAF dropped 32,000 bombs on the city. This is really overkill. They then chose other cities. Kiel on July 24th, Stuttgart on July 24th through the 29th, Stettin on August 17th, and Königsberg on August 30th. The RAF dropped the incendiaries on Kaiserslautern on September 27th and destroyed 36% of the buildings. In that town, the stick-type incendiaries were very effective, burning alive at least 144 people, mostly women and children. The RAF stopped using the flame jet bomb, another type of incendiary, towards the end of the war as they had left very little to burn in Germany. They had already dropped 80 million bombs of this type and were quite pleased with the results, especially in Dresden, where they used 650,000 of them. Hamburg was still an Anglophile city, and many residents did not expect that Britain would bomb it. Hamburg citizens had viewed the British as friends and allies for 150 years when the city was part of the Hanseatic League and a trading partner since 1600. Nevertheless, the British bombed Hamburg for the first time on May 18, 1940. On May 27, 1943, Harris presented his plans to destroy the city. Initially, the Allies used high explosives devised to create a huge fire in the center of Hamburg to draw the city's firefighters. Then they bombed in concentric circles around the city to entrap and incinerate the firefighters. They followed this up with the use of napalm and white phosphorus incendiaries. This unique bombing pattern created a fiery vortex and, combined with the warm summer weather, produced a 1,500-foot-high tornado of fire. Bomber Command executed an incendiary attack against Hamburg, which started so many fires that a firestorm developed. Survivors described it as a giant hurricane of flame that incinerated at least 40,000 people and everything else in its way. The men of Bomber Command envisioned a firestorm for Berlin, which would have given them a militarily meaningful victory and would have fulfilled the dreams of the men who created Bomber Command. Freeman Dyson wrote, and I quote, "We killed altogether about 400,000 Germans, one-third of them, in the two firestorms in just Hamburg and Dresden." Of course, that does not count those who might have perished from exposure and starvation because of those attacks. People in Hamburg actually caught fire just as quickly and easily as paper does. Sorry, I just cannot imagine that a group of people who claim to be so civilized could act in such a cruel way. I cannot imagine the Americans and the British doing these cruel, cruel things, especially when you consider that Germans came to this country early, came to America early, and were some of the biggest contributors to the culture of America. This is just unimaginable that so-called civilized people could do this. Individuals who were close to the phosphorus bombs had melting phosphorus fall on their eyes and skin, which burnt incessantly and bored its way into bone and internal organs. Operation Gomorrah, in addition to the 50,000 dead civilians, rendered more than 1 million German citizens homeless. about 3,000 planes dropped 9,000 tons of bombs, destroying over 250,000 homes. One would assume that the Allies would be finished bombing Hamburg, but the city suffered 69 additional air raids before and following the week-long attack, beginning July 24, 1943, most of which targeted Germany's oil industry. In this respect, the atomic bomb and the Hamburg phosphorus bomb both fit into the same paradigm. In the first days after the Hamburg firestorm, workers collected at least 10,000 corpses, a veritable mountain, and then buried them, a job typically managed by the air protection police. First, the workers had to sprinkle them with chlorinated lime to eliminate the stench and for sanitary measures. Whole neighborhoods soon smelled of the lime. Recovery crews outfitted with gas masks working in cellars had the most nauseating and challenging assignment. Intact bodies were collected and placed on a truck. Workers then had to search through the rubble for body parts. Sometimes because of the hellish enveloping fire, there was nothing left except a piece of gold jewelry. They buried thousands of bodies in four huge mass graves, with about 10,000 in each one, on the outskirts of Hamburg at the Ohlsdorf Cemetery, as they did not pose a health risk. If that had been the case, they would have burned them. A coal depot by Hamburg's Hagenbeck Zoo blazed long after the bombing. A bomb hit the floor. Let me just see what there's a message here. Okay. Alrighty. A coal depot by Hamburg's Hagenbeck Zoo blazed long after the bombing. A bomb hit a floor polish factory, and hot polish flowed freely down the road. Residents had to walk through the hot liquid just to get water from a hydrant across the road. The bombing destroyed thousands of homes in addition to widespread destruction of all infrastructure, gas, electricity, and water. Even outside of the bombed areas made life extremely difficult. People, if they were fortunate enough to still have a home, could not cook and had to walk for miles just to get water. The British bombed the Hagenbeck Zoo and killed four zookeepers and five other employees who were attempting to put out the dozens of fires. The zebra house suffered a direct hit. About 120 large animals were killed immediately, and untold numbers of smaller animals were severely wounded, dying, or were killed outright when the bombs hit. An 8,000-pound bomb hit near the facility that held the large cats, and several were able to escape the fiery blaze. Workers had to shoot two jaguars and a Siberian tiger to put them out of their misery. The big cats, I love cats, unquestionably panic-stricken, which were unable to escape, burned to death. Workers rounded up many of the surviving animals, put them on a train, and attempted to send them to safety in Bavaria. However, while the train was en route just east of the city, the Allies bombed it and killed all of the animals that were fortunate enough to have survived the initial bombing. A zoo official compiled a report in which he told of the devastation caused by the incendiaries. All the main buildings, both restaurants, the cow sheds, the deer and goat houses, the aviary, the zebra stalls, the baboon enclosure, the monkey bath, the rhesus monkey enclosure, the aquarium, and other buildings burned. German zoo officials were the first to use open enclosures surrounded by moats instead of cages. This was more humane, and resemble the animals' natural habitats. The bombing destroyed the zoo. Germany would rebuild it following the war. Alrighty, we're going to a break. We will be back.
Beat you down and break your heart, steal your crown.
All righty, we are back. This is Deanna, and I am subbing for John, and I really appreciate the opportunity to do that and to share something that that we all need to know about. And of course, this is, as I mentioned before, the 70th anniversary of the Allied bombing of Dresden, which occurred between February 13th through the 15th in 1945. And this was a terrible time, the destruction that the Allies did in Germany, the infrastructure, the millions of people. When you think about Eisenhower's death camps, I mean, it's just overwhelming. All right, let's talk about Dresden. The following bit of background might help to explain why the Allies bombed Dresden. Many countries had banished the Jews. According to one author, Andrew C. Hitchcock, officials of several countries had banished Jews at least 47 times just in a period covering 1,000 years. On November 21st, 1879, Professor Jesse H. Holmes in The American Hebrew, a weekly journal first published in New York City, wrote, and I quote, "It can hardly be an accident that antagonism directed against the Jews is to be found pretty much everywhere in the world where Jews and non-Jews are associated. And as the Jews are the common element of the situation, it would seem probable on the face of it that the cause will be found in them rather than in the widely varying groups which feel this antagonism," unquote. By the late 1870s, the Germans claimed that Jews and their parasitism posed a threat to all Christian nations. Many Germans said that Christianity saved the Europeans from moral bankruptcy and established Europe's civilization and culture on a firm religious, moral, and social foundation. The Germans of the day said that Christianity was a powerful response against Jewish world domination and a protest against the Jewish elevation over other peoples. Therefore, they felt that Jewry can only achieve its supposed superiority and world dominance if it succeeds in overpowering and destroying Christianity and Christian nations, the initial target of its vicious attacks. During the movement of self-protection, many Germans wanted to revoke Jewish emancipation. Now, I talk about Jewish emancipation in the first and second books and how it happened, who was behind it. I give a whole history of everything that happened in Europe regarding the Jews and what they were doing over there. In conjunction, are we going to a break? Okay, we're going to a break. We will be back shortly.
Stick us and bleed us and take all our money and send it abroad. We must take America back. We need
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
The American dream has become a nightmare. Signs of the time are on cardboard, on corners in town. Like a cancer that's silently spreading, there's an unspoken fear, we're on our way down. We must take America back, Main Street to Wall Street, cities and states, Washington, D.C.
Alrighty, we are back. Thank you for joining me today. This is Deanna, and I'm subbing for John Stattmiller, who messed up his back moving furniture in the office, and so he invited me to sub for him. So hopefully he will be feeling better soon. Now, during a movement of self-protection, many Germans wanted to revoke Jewish emancipation. Now, remember that the Germans were the first to allow them emancipation. They were trying to help them. And of course, some Jews paid some officials off, and that's really how it all happened. So in conjunction with these efforts, officials convened the first anti-Jewish Congress in Dresden on September 11th through the 12th in 1882. The delegates from all over Europe agreed that prior government policies, and I quote, in defense of the Christian state, unquote, had proved entirely ineffective. They devised a document called the Manifesto to the Governments and Peoples of the Christian Nations Threatened by Judaism, a document that described the international Jewish conspiracy with abundant evidence substantiating the Jews, and I quote, lust for world domination, unquote. So, this was in 1882. So, and of course we all know that the Marxist revolutions in Germany or in Europe occurred in 1848. And actually, many of the people, they were not entirely successful, of course. And so a lot of those Marxists came over to the United States and fought on the side of the North. So you might just as well say that the Civil War was a Marxist revolution. And although they were unsuccessful in Europe, they were very successful in this country. Now, during that historic meeting in Dresden, they discussed their many concerns regarding the Jews, including the Masonic-based French Revolution that eliminated the protective policies that Christian people had constructed to defend themselves against the Jews' predatory practices, such as usury, their trade monopoly, their control of credit, their control over publishing, and other very influential areas of society, all permitted and encouraged by Jewish religious dogma, which maintains that God had chosen them as his, and I quote, privileged people, unquote. During that Congress, the delegates also discussed the Jewish Talmud, which states that the rest of humanity are little more than animals created to serve the Jews, who could cheat, steal, lie, ruin, and essentially kill non-Jews. They acknowledged how the Jews dominate the financial markets through which they seek to dominate the world. They control the stock exchanges through which they regulate the price of money, commodities, and industrial goods. During this historic Congress at Dresden, the participants agreed. I think we're going to a break. We'll be back in 3 minutes. All righty. We are back. This is Deanna. I was talking about the Congress at Dresden, which occurred on September 11th through the 12th in 1882 against what I believe is the true tribe of Judah. Okay, during this historic Congress at Dresden, the participants agreed that the Jews, or the people who call themselves Jews, control capitalism, which recently was referred to as Rothschild's European plan, which I referred to in my second book, which includes agriculture, business, and labor. In other words, they do it all. The Jews govern the banks and monopolize all financial institutions and decide who receives credit. Therefore, farmers, landowners, artisans, industrialists, and merchants depend on the Jews for their material wants and necessities, their very livelihood, putting everyone into servitude. Further, they agreed that Jews logistically position and bankroll influential men at their banks, railways, insurance companies, and newspapers. Now remember, this is in 1882. These Jewish vassals, then and now, become the most enthusiastic supporters of Jewish influence in the parliaments and governments. Think about the influence that they have in the U.S. government. Well, in most governments. Benjamin Disraeli revealed this pervasive influence in his 1852 novel, Coningsby, wherein the character Sidonia says, and I quote, "So you see, my dear Coningsby, that the world is governed by very different personages from what is imagined by those who are not behind the scenes," unquote. In Dresden, during that 1882 Congress, the delegates referred to the Rothschilds and the other bankers who, then and now, continue to exploit impoverished nations who, urged by those bankers, wage war in order to remain financially viable. Yet warfare adds billions to the Jews' burgeoning vaults and functions to concentrate more of the assets of the Europeans into the hands of the Jews while manipulating their national calamities. The delegates recognized how the Jews, through the burden of national debt, sap every nation's marrow, how their governments evolve into Jewish institutions and collection agencies. The delegates understood what compelled government officials to often abandon the necessities and desires of their own populations in favor of Jewry. Okay, so they knew in 1882, a long time ago, 140 years ago, the participants at Dresden in 1882 noted how the Jews control the majority of the periodicals and newspapers and fabricate public opinion and suppress all criticism of their behavior. And until recently, no newspaper in Central Europe would reveal the truth about them. The Jews repress any mention of their dominance, and in their media, praise and rebuke individuals according to their servitude of the Jewish agenda. Public servants curry favor with the Jewish press and the tribe in order to advance their career, which generates intellectual slavery and moral cowardice, mere minions of Jewish power. These, and I quote, public servants, unquote, become traitors to their own country and people. The participants pointed out that in many nations, the Jews have contaminated Freemasonry and turned the lodges into instruments of Jewish power. Through the press, Jewry undermines Christianity, which is, and I quote, a racially specific religion of the Aryan European peoples, unquote. The delegates clearly elaborated on numerous Jewish propensities, but perhaps did not sufficiently cover the Jewish trait of revenge. In 1543, Martin Luther said, and I quote, "Oh, how fond they, the Jews, are of the book of Esther, which is so beautifully attuned to their bloodthirsty, vengeful, murderous yearning and hope. The sun has never shone on a more bloodthirsty and vengeful people than they are who imagine that they are God's people who have been commissioned and commanded to murder and to slay the Gentiles," unquote. And this was Martin Luther in 1543. Even though the bombing of Dresden occurred about 2 weeks before Purim, the deliverance of the Jews, is what Purim is supposed to be, in 1945, which fell on February 27th that year, it is still significant as there is no definitive timetable that they seem to apply that vengeance from generation to generation. Frederick Lindemann, a Jew, directed Britain's deadly strategic bombing campaign against Germany. He had detailed maps of all the cities showing population densities. Is it just coincidental that Britain and her bombing ally targeted Dresden, the site of that historic meeting, on September 11th through 12th, 1882? I think not. By early February 1943, refugees, particularly women and children from bombed out cities, had fled to Dresden for safety from other locations. Dresden's normal population of 640,000 had increased to as many as 1 million inhabitants. The bombings occurred on the night of February 13th and 14th of 1945. On Ash Wednesday, in a city filled with Catholics from Silesia who had fled from the Red Army, when a Catholic priest applies the ashes to the forehead of his parishioners, he says, and I quote, "Remember, O man, that thou art dust, and unto dust thou shalt return," unquote. According to Friedrich, J-O-R-G, Friedrich, the Allied bombing killed about 40,000, while others state the number of deaths was as high as 500,000 or more, probably more. During the previous year, authorities transformed many of Dresden's schools into hospital wards, as there were so many wounded people. The regular hospitals, 19 of them, were overcrowded. During the assault, the Allies severely damaged 16 of the 19 regular hospitals, while completely demolishing 3 hospitals, including the maternity clinic. You know, it's kind of interesting. There was a there was a Jewish hospital right in the middle of Berlin during the entire war that didn't have any damage whatsoever. It was a safety zone. They had enough food. That hospital remained intact and safe. Yet, the regular hospitals in Dresden, 19 of them, out of those 19, 16 of them were completely demolished. Brave nurses managed to get thousands of wounded survivors to the banks of the River Elbe, where they would be safe until daylight. However, 211 American planes began an attack at 11:30 a.m. Whoops, we're going to a break. We'll be right back. I am back. This is Deanna, and I am subbing for John today, and hopefully he will be feeling better. Now, I was talking about the attack on 16 of the 19 regular hospitals in Dresden. I mean, what kind of savages would go after a hospital? This is just sickening. And I'm sorry to read this stuff. But I am more of a writer than I am a conversationalist. There's no way of sharing this without sharing the details. So that's what I do. I write. So there were a lot of brave nurses who managed to get thousands of wounded survivors to the banks of the River Elbe, where they would be safe until daylight. They didn't run the other way. Those brave German nurses took care of those patients as well as they possibly could. However, 211 American planes began an attack at 11:30 a.m. when dozens of low-flying Mustang fighters specifically targeted the wounded survivors gathered by the river and the adjacent expanse of the Grosse Garten. Meanwhile, other Mustang pilots, apparently driven by some sadistic mentality, dive-bombed the crowds of panicked survivors attempting to escape the burning city. There were 28,410 houses in Dresden, out of which the bombing incinerated 24,866. The Allied bombing also torched and destroyed at least 13 square miles. Just that night, the Allies dropped more than 2,600 tons of high explosives and incendiaries on Dresden, including the historic city center, the site of treasured works of art and beautiful buildings. As I mentioned, the death toll varies. They stopped counting after they had identified 35,000 bodies. German authorities estimated, within just a few days of the attack, that the death toll was somewhere between 120,000 to 150,000. Friedrich states that there were at least 800,000 people and maybe as many as a million on the night of the firebombing, February 13th through the 14th, 1945. Yet only 640,000 were regular inhabitants of the city. The United States and the British destroyed from 50 to 80% of all German cities with a population over 50,000. They reduced smaller cities to rubble. Between February 13th and the 15th, 1945, British and American forces firebombed Dresden in four separate raids, using over 3,900 tons of high-explosive incendiary bombs. Dresden, the Baroque capital of Saxony, was a non-military target about the size of Pittsburgh. It was home to over 600,000, of which the United States and the British incinerated at least 40,000, but we know that the numbers were higher, as I indicated before. The Allied pilots could only produce a firestorm if they were exceptionally accurate and if the Germans were unable to defend a particular city. The firestorm in Dresden was the most effective from the Allied viewpoint. The Allies saw it as a whole in one similar to a game of golf. The city had little if any military significance at all, and the slaughter came too late to have any serious effect on the war. Keep in mind, this was right in the end of the war. The war ended formally on May 8th, 1945. This was in February. I mean, the war was already pretty much over. The once beautiful city burned for 5 days. The bombing destroyed all five theaters. Nine churches out of 54 were totally gone, while the bombing severely damaged 38. They destroyed 69 out of the 139 schools, while seriously damaging 50. All right, we're going to a break, and we will take your calls later on. Anyway, we'll be right back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and I am subbing for John, and we were talking just before the break about Dresden, and I had mentioned that the Allies destroyed 69 out of 139 schools, and obviously those schools had children in them, probably thinking that that was a very good place, a very safe place to be, because what kind of psychopaths would consider bombing a school? Well, we know that answer, don't we? The wounded animal survivors from the city's zoo panicked and attempted to escape the city. Workers had to shoot some of the seriously wounded as they could not take care of them, given the circumstances where even the human survivors were in a desperate situation. What kind of people, again, target the wounded and the fleeing crowds after the hospitals, churches, schools, and zoos had already been assaulted by their partners, the British? It was not warfare. It was genocide. While the bankers hated Hitler, they want to make certain, through the media and controlled education, that everyone else hated him. including the surviving Germans who they denazified after the war. By February or March 1945, and as I mentioned, we will take your phone calls at 800-313-9443. We welcome your questions and your comments. By February or March 1945, the Allies had destroyed Germany's transportation, oil supply, and morale. Harris and his bomber command really did not have to continue the bombing and razing of cities, as it was not necessary to the war efforts. For instance, the town of Forzheim in southwestern Germany was bombed numerous times. The most devastating assault took place on the night of February 23, 1945. Forzheim, in addition to Hamburg, Kassel, and Dresden, was another one of about a dozen cities where a firestorm erupted. On May 20th, 1945, Pastor Carl Seifert, now this was after the formal ending of the war. Pastor Carl Seifert and some elderly peasants stood by the banks of the Elbe River, approximately 15 miles upstream from Dresden. The leader of the Soviet occupation permitted this pastor and the peasants to bury the bodies that floated ashore day after day. Thousands floated by. Children, women, old men, and soldiers. The pastor and the parents said a prayer as they buried the bodies. The river delivered bundles tied with barbed wire, corpses without tongues, eyes, breasts, testicles, and even a wooden bedstead floating like a raft. The Soviets had nailed a family to the bedstead using long spikes. As the pastor and his helpers pulled the spikes out of the children's hands, envisioning the horror that this family must have experienced, said, and I quote, "Lord, what have we done that they must sin so?" He could say nothing more except, "Lord, have mercy on their souls," unquote. In Kassel, it was a similar situation. There's a YouTube video that shows the pre-destruction footage when the Allies had already bombed the city 10 times. On October 22nd, 1943, we're backtracking here a bit, they totally destroyed this beautiful old city in one night of conventional bombing and firebombing. They dropped 420,000 tons of bombs. 2 hours later, there were 150,000 homeless people. Per the official statistics, the bombing killed 10,000 and severely injured another 10,000. In comparison, 20,000 British people died as a result of German bombing. Britain used four-engine Lancaster bombers, and that carried a maximum payload of 6,000 metric tons. That is over four times the maximum load of the largest German twin-engine bombers, which they did not design for this purpose. Actually, Germany was totally unprepared for war. Poland was more prepared for warfare than Germany was. Within a few hours, the Allies torched almost 10,000 people during the firestorm in Kassel on the evening of October 23rd, 1943, as I mentioned. Bomber Harris, his crew, dropped over 1,823 tons of high explosives and firebombs. Cassell consisted of 960 acres of buildings, houses, and factories. Out of that total, the Allies destroyed 615 acres, including 300 acres of working class housing. On November 30th, 1943, a preliminary damage report stated that 26,702 homes were destroyed, rendering over 120,000 people homeless. Of the 55,000 homes within the city, 65% were uninhabitable. On December 7th, Cassell's police chief thought that the Allies had either seriously damaged or destroyed about 10,000 homes. He estimated the number of homeless as 150,000. The UN's bombing survey said in 1945 that 91,000 people were homeless because of the bombing that night. They thought they had destroyed about 61% of the housing. Cassell's pre-bomb population was 228,000. Now keep in mind that the labor camps, that was a pretty safe place to be. And you also have to keep in mind that that all this bombing affected Germany's ability to transport food, to transport anything, because of all the transportation with all the Allied bombing, the communications and transportation. Were gone for the Germans and for anybody in Germany. So the death toll in Cassell was about 10,000, which was relatively low unless you happen to be one of them or a family member. The initial report on November 30th, 1943, represented 5,599, with only 3,782 actually identifiable. See, I'm getting a message here. Alrighty, why don't we take a break? Let's take a caller. Let's take Dave from Boston. Dave, welcome.
Oh, hi, Deanna. I'm enjoying your show. You're doing a bang up job calling in for Mr. Statmiller. Hey Deanna, I was wondering, and I'm sure Mr. Statmiller will hear my question to you. I know you can't answer for Mr. Statmiller, for Mr. John Statmiller, but I was wondering, now that Mr. John Statmiller has found the time. I know he's a busy man, but he finally found the time to watch Adolf Hitler, the greatest story never told. And I was wondering, and it seemed to resonate with Mr. Statmiller, and I was wondering if after watching the greatest story never told, if he possibly would be amenable to allowing Carolyn Yeager to have a show again on Republic Broadcasting.
I think you'd probably have to ask Mr. Statmiller.
I think a couple of years ago, Carolyn, for a few months, for a relatively short time, she had a show on RBN.
Like I say, this is not a question to be asking me. I have no jurisdiction over the host on RBN, and I think that you would, have to ask him. So I would suggest that you call in when he is hosting his program. I'm sure that he really enjoyed if you can enjoy watching The Greatest Story Never Told, because you cry, that's what I did. It's a very moving, very wonderful video, and I don't know why Carolyn left. I don't know. You're asking questions that I am not able to answer, so I think you should redirect your question to him. And so thank you for your call. Do you have any other questions that are relevant?
Oh, no, the only reason I put it out, Deanna, to you now was just I know John will hear my words. He told me never to call into his show again, so I'm banned from calling into his show.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well,
he wouldn't give me a reason. As usual, he never gives. He banned.
Well, you know, hey. That, you know, this is not the time to be bashing him when he's not here to defend himself, and I think it's kind of rude to do that. So I thank you for your call and your question, and we'll move on to Fred. We do have a break coming up, but Fred, welcome.
Hi, Deanna.
Hi.
I had to call. I didn't know John was off today, but I'm glad you're there. As always, the end of the year emergency, what was that, an emergency spending bill, if that's the appropriate description, included $800 billion, which came out on C-SPAN, $800 billion to reconstruct Afghanistan. $800 billion to reconstruct Iraq. And last but not least, my favorite idyllic getaway, Israel, $400 billion. And a lady called recently to John's broadcast and declared that a lady congressman in the last 4 years made a special speech to Congress that declared something like $2.5 to $3 trillion in donations, taxpayer donations, to Israel and since its inception, and wondering, gee, where's our return on that investment? Just the murders of all these Arab people, perpetual war for perpetual peace over there. And then I recalled Extortion 17, the families of the murdered special forces who were, who knows, maybe they were beginning to talk about the manufactured bin Laden hit in Pakistan, which anyone with a functioning brain who's listened to your broadcast and others would automatically know that was a fraudulent event. And they had to die, like that Tillman had to die, because as Tillman began to communicate back home, he intended to go on a lecture circuit regarding the lies of Afghanistan being the CIA-directed U.S. military reconstruct of the opium, heroin, poppy fields, which have been destroyed by the leader of the Taliban back in 2000. They obliterated the poppy fields. So, Extortion 17, I haven't heard anyone bring that up, and I wish we could contact the family members to get them on your broadcast.
Oh, I have. The Tillman family, yes. And certainly they were aware and are aware that he was assassinated to keep him silenced. And of course, all the people in the United States, as I said before, that history is prologue. And if people really knew the history of the Jews from, before that, obviously, but from 1848, and particularly all of the things that they talked about in that meeting in 1882, we probably wouldn't be having the situation, all the money going out of the pockets of the taxpayers here in this country over to Israel and to repair or supposedly to rebuild the countries that the U.S. government the U.S. military has destroyed. And, of course, those countries are not being rebuilt. That money is going right into the pockets of the tribe. And so, of course, we, you know, most of the American people are totally unaware of this. That is why it is so essential to know and to understand accurate history. But you're not going to get that from court historians. Because they don't talk about these things. Okay, I believe we're going to a quick break. Fred, I really appreciate your phone call.
Thank you.
And the things that you've brought up. Terrific. So, we'll be right back.
I guess I don't know. When I get there, I'm learning to fly around the clouds. But what goes up must come down.
Are back. This is Deanna. I'm subbing for John, and we have Kenny from Pennsylvania. Kenny, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. And you?
Pretty good. Hanging in there. Can I get that CD? Is it a CD or a couple CDs? Is it? Do you sell them?
On what?
On the what you're talking about today.
The information.
The story never told.
The Greatest Story Never Told is available online, and
I have no computer. I have no computer, no TV, or none of that. So I have to purchase it. Yeah.
Okay. Can you email me and I'll give you some information about it, Deanna?
I don't have a computer.
Okay.
No email, no nothing. No.
Well, gosh, I don't know what to tell you. But it is available online. It is available as a CD. It's put out by Dennis Wise. You can call into the station and maybe get some information about it, or call me. I'm not sure. Go to the library. Your local library has a computer that you can use. You can email me, and I will give you some information about that CD, The Greatest Story Never Told. Okay.
Okay. And how long does it run?
6 hours.
6 hours?
Yes.
Okay.
Great.
Okay,
thanks.
Thank you.
Let's take Ed in Dallas. Ed, welcome to the program.
Hello, Dan. How are you?
I'm good. And you?
How are you? I'm just going to tell you, you did such an excellent job just now talking about all that, and it made me reminisce a little bit back towards my conversations with my dad. He was in the World War II. I'm not proud of it at all, but at least he didn't actually participate in any of the killings. I don't think he ever fired his gun one time. He was a transport. He transported in the DC-7. He just transported materials, you know, and he told me that he did once or twice drop troops in certain areas where there was fighting. But he said he never did participate in the war. But one of the things I wanted to bring up was just the fact that he told me that when he went to England, that he noticed that the buildings that were blown up in England were of no significance. He said what was blown up was like old warehouses and things like that. There were all kinds of churches and things they could have bombed and destroyed like they did, you know, Germany. But they didn't do that. He said that everything that was bombed looked to him like it was all insignificant things. And so that was important to show that Hitler was not actually in to be mean to anyone. He was just trying to, I guess, in England's case, I guess just to make a showing, I guess, to stop them from with all those bombings like you were talking about, those night raids. And so I thought that was interesting, and I know that that the main objective, one of the main objectives of Hitler, was to regain the four territories, or I should say, reunite the four territories that were lost during World War One, because the people in those four territories
were mostly German. Yes.
So he was trying to reunite Germany because he realized what had happened. He knew what had happened. And matter of fact, he was involved in the war.
And we have run out of time. I so appreciate your phone call. And I thank you very much for calling into the program today and for listening. And I appreciate all the listeners. Thanks so much for joining us today on RBN. And John, get well. Take care of yourself, and thank you for the opportunity to stand in for you. I appreciate it. Bye-bye, listeners. Take care.